You are listening to African Perspectives with host Brother Oshi on Time for an Awakening Media, part of the Black Talk Radio Network. For podcasting or live program scheduling, hit them up at timeforanawakening@gmail.com.
Get to people, yeah.
What are you gonna
You are listening to African Perspectives, where we review the issues of our day from an African worldview and African-centered perspective. This program is unapologetically African. It is a custom in the African tradition to ask elders for permission to speak, having been granted permission. To our ancestors, whose shoulders we stand on, to our elders, whose shadows we walk in, I greet you, my dear brothers and sisters. In the language of one of the greatest civilizations on this planet, it gave the world the basic disciplines of knowledge of science, math, architecture, music, writing, law, religion, you name it, we did it. The Greeks called it Egypt, but they called themselves Kemet, and Kemet means land of the blacks. I greet you all in the Kemetic language, the word of peace, Hotep. It is truly an honor and a privilege to pour libation because we truly do stand on the shoulders of those who came before us. We're going to use water because water has no enemies. Water is the great cleanser, the great purifier. Everything on the planet that lives, it needs water, from a tiny microscopic organism to a tall redwood tree. We pour water into the earth to invoke the spirits of our ancestors, and we say the word Ashe, which simply means so be it. So we pour this libation to God for all that God has done and for all that God will do. We say Ashe. We pour this libation to Mother Africa, birthplace of all humanity, everyone who has lived, everyone who will live in the future. We all have a common ancestral root in Africa. We pour this libation to the classical civilizations of Africa. I mentioned Kemet in the opening. Kemet was the height, the apex, the zenith of African high culture. But there were others as well, as Timari, Punt, and Nubia. So we pour this libation to the classical civilizations of Africa. We say Ashe. We pour this libation to the contemporary civilizations of Africa, of Ghana, Mali, Songhai, Benin, Great Zimbabwe, civilizations that were flourishing and growing while Europe was in a medieval or dark age. The University of Sankore at Timbuktu, an outstanding educational institution. So we pour this libation to the contemporary civilizations of Africa. We say Ashe. We pour this libation to the Maafa, the Holocaust of our enslavement, the Infakani, the great tragedy, uprooted out of Africa. Our brothers and sisters lay a carpet along the Atlantic Ocean. We're in North America, South America, Central America, and throughout the diaspora. So we pour this libation to our brothers and sisters who suffered the Maafa, the Infakani, the Holocaust of our enslavement, the great tragedy. We pour this libation in their honor and in their memory. We do not know their names, but because of them and their sacrifice, we are here. So we say Ashe. We pour this libation to those who fought against enslavement. If you ever heard me do a libation, you will know that we were not slaves. I repeat, we were not slaves. We were captives. What does a captive want to do? Get free. So we pour this libation to all those men and women who fought against enslavement. In fact, I maintain that some of us are more of a slave today than we were in our initial captivity, because some of us are a slave to vice, to corruption, to drugs, sex, and violence. So we pour this libation to those who fought against enslavement. Gabriel Prosser, Nat Turner, Dingmark Vesey, Harriet Tubman. We always resisted, and we will always resist. So we pour this libation in the name and the honor of those men and women who fought against our captivity. We pour this libation to those unborn, those young men and women who will once again lead us back on the stage of human history as a free and proud and productive people. We sashay. We pour this libation to brotherhood and sisterhood, together for the union of family. We need each other. We don't have good family life. There's a saying, conditions shape conduct and consciousness. The conditions in our community are bad. The conduct towards each other is not good. Because why? We lack consciousness. And consciousness is more than just awareness. Consciousness is a deeper understanding of who you are historically, who you are culturally. So once we begin to understand the importance of brotherhood and sisterhood together for the union of family. Brothers and sisters, let us all say, Ashe, Ashe.
You are listening to Time for an Awakening Media, part of the Black Talk Radio Network. For podcasts or live programming, hit them up at timeforanawakening.com.
Good morning, African world. You are listening to African Perspectives here on the Motherland Media Network, on timeforanawakening.com and blacktalkradionetwork.com. And I am your host, Baba Oshi. Hotep family, hope everything is well with you today. Hope you're going to have a good day. Get a chance to do all the things you want to do, should do, must do, can do, will do. And hoping that the weather will be accommodating for you to do it. But of course, if it is not, you're going to get it done anyway, because that's the kind of brother and sister that you is. This is African Perspectives. We're here every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday from 11 a.m. to 1 p.m., 10 to 12 Central, 9 to 11 Mountain, or 8 to 10 Pacific, any other time around the world. But if you cannot listen to this program live, you can go to the archives at timeforanawakening.com. Top of the page, you'll see podcast programs. Click on that. To drop down, you'll see African Perspectives. You'll see African Perspectives. Click on that, and there will be programs that are dated and titled. Thanks to my good brother, Brother Quake, who appreciates you, man. I'm just going to go to other programming we have here on Time for an Awakening, and then I'm going to read from the Inyasasim, which I do every program, the wise words, the quotes, and the wise words of our guest, Baba Mwali Mubarudi. Not a lot of programming here on Time for an Awakening. I got to check with Brother Elliot to see if there's anything new. But on Thursday from 8 to 10, Black Liberation Movement, Mississippi on the Move, Brother Patrick Lumumba of the Geronimo Pratt Gun Club from 8 to 10. Fridays from 8 p.m., Time for an Awakening with Brother Elliot and Brother Richard. On Saturdays from 7 to 9, the Sankofa Elders Council with Dr. Janine. And then on Sunday at 7 p.m., Time for an Awakening with Brother Elliot and Brother Richard. And, of course, the number to call is 215-490-9832. 215-490-9832. Once we read the Inyasasim, we'll have Baba Barudi and get on with the conversation. June 16th. So, speak truth, do justice, be kind, and do not do evil. Truth travels on a narrow path, but the wicked wander on a wide road. Speak truth, do justice. Do justice and speak truth, for one who is righteous is supported by the divine. Odu Ifa. It is not a contradiction to tell someone that you see them as being wise and yet not give them the space to speak. Or is this the only tactical play on reciprocity to gain their attention and favor so that they will listen without interrupting you as you speak? It is not a contradiction for someone to say, no disrespect intended, but then use that qualification as a license to disrespect you. It is not a contradiction to trick someone into a mode of serious listening for constructive criticism by saying, with all due respect, when the objective is to give them none through phrasing your statement in a disrespectful way. When you hear words like these, hold your guard, warriors, because some of you will issue from minds filled with fears of you, power-hungry insecurities, and the general need of those socialized within Yoruba's culture to receive respect without having to give any. Success in manipulating others through unrighteous ploys intended to disarm them is a sign of superiority to most underachievers. So their approach is not accidental. Respond accordingly. One non-response from the same face, whether oblivious or hateful, is enough. No warrior should allow themselves to be not reciprocated twice. Affirm, I travel a narrow path. That's what warriors do.
affirm I travel a narrow path. June 17th, what a greater crime could be committed against you than the theft of your soul? Milan Khalid. Because we are human and blessed with being African, when looking at the lowest levels of everyday survival many of our people experience daily, we should feel something. Some level of despair should tug at our hearts every time a brother or sister on the street asks for a dime, a piece of a meal, especially a hug or a hand to shake in recognition that they are not invisible. Every African who is African at heart should feel compelled to do something concrete about whole human beings recast in the image of lone, diseased, untouchable creatures scavenging for food, drugs, and whatever else to which their vision of survival and sanity has been reduced. Hating, blaming, and mistreating the homelessness, the abused, the socially ostracized, and terrorized is completely and totally un-African. Of course, there are some among us who have no desire to be of Ma'at. They seek an escape from the feelings of responsibility for their fellow relatively disadvantaged Africans. They do not see us as family, and their selfish, extreme individualism does not allow them to truly see themselves as anyone's keeper, lest it is in some way beneficial to them. They give to no one without They give to no one without expectation. Woof. You know, help me, Lord. When in Rome, do as the Romans do is music to the ears because it lends to a seemingly timeless reason to their de-emotionalized self, self-centered and self-hatred. It gives them the appearance of strategically imitating Urugu simply to be normal in a reality where abnormality rules. It misdirects them from the fact that they are doing what the Romans do for no higher reason than because they want to become Roman. They want to be Roman. They want to be Caucasian. They want to be Europeanized. Affirm, I do not follow the way of insanity. Affirm, I do not follow the way of insanity. Brothers and sisters, the Inya Sesem of Daily Revolutionary Thought. Sorry, I had a hard time getting through that. I don't know what that... much apologies. Baba Baruti.
Baba Hoshi, how you doing?
I'm doing well now.
Oh, you remind me of me often in terms of getting it out.
Yeah.
That comes with the territory. It makes us know we're human.
That's for sure, brother. Believe me, we are. Believe me, we are. How have you been?
I'm glad that you said those lines because we do walk a narrow path.
Yeah, we do. We do.
A topic of discussion as people are trying to turn what it means to be African, what it means to be a warrior, into things that it's not.
Yeah. Especially
they're not those things. We love our people. We take care of our people.
Right. And that is what it's about.
That's our priority here.
It is. That's what it's about.
We're talking about that on Saturday, which is a beautiful, beautiful thing. It's new. There's a sister, and I'm very sure you know her. If not by name, then you know her on site. Mm-hmm. Sister Jendai, who has secured a building, a space on a little bit of land. And it's like the perfect size for, you know, lectures, 30, 40, 50 people. And we were there yesterday talking about the warrior's character. And it all comes down to, you know, the point for today.
Mm-hmm.
You have to accept that you're going to walk this narrow path. You can't be all these other things and claim to be African or claim to be a warrior because that's not our ancestors. You know, that's a hard thing to accept in a reality where contradiction is the norm.
Right.
We have even reached a point ourselves where we're judging each other. It seems like more and more with each generation. And I'm not faulting them. That's socialization in this reality. But it seems like every generation is becoming more and more contradictory and more celebrating of their contradictoriness, if that's such a word.
Yeah.
And it's scary to me because I'm always trying to see, okay, well, what's this going to be like when my grandchildren turn 20, 30?
Mm-hmm.
You know, what is this going to look like for them? How are they going to see how they're supposed to treat people?
Mm-hmm.
Will they also look at what it means to be African and say, that's ridiculous. Nobody acts like that. Nobody has that kind of discipline. Who would want to have that kind of discipline anyway when you can play all day long? When you can just use people and, you know, measure yourself and your worth on your ability to use people better than anybody else. And to really begin to see this kick in with the redefinition of being a hustler. And I know, you know, back in our day, if you were a hustler or you were a thug, it was a whole different animal.
Sure.
You there were some people you didn't step toward unless you you're ready to die. And they redefined it in such a way that it's a measurement of your ability to get over on people.
Right.
To lie to people and be able to profit from people, right or wrong.
Mm-hmm.
And I know I'm stretching this out, but I asked people on Saturday, and I've asked people years ago, they need to read Max Weber's The Protestant Ethic and the Spirit of Capitalism. And very seldom do I recommend reading books by Europeans, but there are certain books that we should read, young adults should read, so they will really get a good understanding as to the thinking behind the behavior that we're aping, pretending like, you know, this means we're being successful. In this book, Max Weber, he's considered, he and a guy named Emil Durkheim, they're considered to be like the fathers of Western sociology. But in this book, Weber, if I could say this succinctly, Weber made the argument in terms of the rise of Protestantism in this world and in Europe, that the reason why it became so popular was because your ability to get into heaven was based upon your ability to accumulate more than other people.
Mm.
So, the more money you had, the more gold you had, the more whatever you had,
mm-hmm.
the more that your nation had, it would get you into heaven. So, you know, the poor people are going to get to heaven, according to, you know, the Protestant ethic. They're not going anywhere near heaven. And the thing that really got me when I was reading the book for I don't know which time, but what got me the most was that it didn't make a difference how you got your money.
Mm.
It didn't make a difference how you accumulated your wealth. Mm. It was just a matter of how much you had. So it just erased the concept, the meaning, the staying power of sinning,
mm-hmm.
however we want to define it, doing wrong, not being righteous. It removed that as a variable in your ability to receive salvation.
So you could be as sinful as hell, dogmatic, greedy, selfish, and you will get it. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely, Bob. When I read that book, it's like, you know, you read certain books like Rabbi Nijirugu, you read certain books and lights, you know, not only do they go off, but you get additional lights above your head.
Right, exactly.
And that was one of those books, and I read it, and I reread it, and I reread it. After a while, I really couldn't believe what I was reading.
Mm-hmm.
Because it was one of those, they put it right in our face, but because we don't read the way we need to read, we don't see it right in our face.
Right.
You know, right. There has to be a way that they have rationalized being the way that they are so that they can see themselves as superior,
mm-hmm.
as supreme, which, of course, they're not. But mm-hmm. it allows them to live with what they're doing. If it's for the good of the creator, the manifest destiny. If it's good for, you know, the creator, if the creator gave me instructions to go out here and take over the world and kill and murder and rape and all the rest of these, the rest of the world, and enslave them, you know, if that's the kind of, you have to have that kind of logic which you argue originates in divinity in order for you to be able to do it and the people who you've done it to accept it as correct. You know, mm-hmm. it's mind-boggling to me. We talk about the second passage that you talked about in terms of, and I'll say particularly young people, not faulting them. Like I said, they were socialized this insanity, and the socialization is making their minds worse. But I have encountered so many people in my short life on the front line who will say, you know, I don't mean to disrespect, and they do.
Yeah, they do.
Actually do, but they want to throw you off guard.
Right, they want to qualify it and then disrespect you.
Yes.
Yeah.
And I can't get upset with them because that has become pretty much the norm.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it starts back, for me, a major part of it starts back where we give our children, through socialization, the permission to interrupt adults.
And I'm not
getting into this adults-children thing, you know, we're better than children. No, we're different. Parents, adults and children are different. They're supposed to be different.
Mm-hmm.
Children play. Adults are supposed to be more serious. This is just the nature of being human, growing up.
Right.
But when you give children the idea that what they say is more important than what the adults say, not that it's maybe equal, but it's more important. You watch them, they will begin to use, excuse me, or Mapaucho if you're saying it in Cree, they will use that to interrupt what you're saying and start talking. Like, that allows them to override anything that you're saying.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a study that was done at the University of Maryland, I think it was in the early 70s, but it was a study that was done at University of Maryland. And it wanted to look, it was looking at, by a group that was looking at the exercise of power between men and women. And it looked at, one of the variables it looked at was interrupting. And they, you know, did their study, and they came to the conclusion that men interrupt women more than women interrupt men. And it was a significant, there was a significant difference.
Okay.
In who interrupted who.
Okay, sure.
And they came to the conclusion, which I agree, because of the nature of interrupting within European culture and society,
mm-hmm.
where interrupting essentially means you need to shut up because what I have to say is more important than you.
Right.
That's what it does. We look at so many different variables within European society to understand how this arrogance, how this sense of superiority is not only part and parcel of, has become part and parcel of their nature, if you will, but it also has a trickle-down effect into us, and we, in mm-hmm. acting like them, have
sure.
to rationalize it.
Right, because we're in it. We're in their system, and their system is very hardcore male patriarchy, very dominating.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Absolutely, Baba.
Mm-hmm.
I remember I can't remember the name of the book. Brother was talking about customs in terms of conversations, meetings, greetings, things like that. In that book, he talked about how in our tradition, if you didn't speak to someone, whether you knew them or not, whether you liked them or not, in your community, it was essentially a declaration of war.
Mm.
It was that important that you speak to everybody. And, of course, we look, particularly in the South, you know that when you walk down the street, you spoke to everybody who you saw.
Sure.
Only now have we gotten to the point where a child can walk into your house and not speak, and it's not their house, and they can keep right on going.
Mm-hmm.
But there was also part of that discussion where they talked about what you did when you came to somebody's house, when you came to somebody's space, where you didn't knock on the door. Knocking was seen as a sign of aggression, where you're banging on this person's house. Let me in now. Mm-hmm. But because we have come to think in that way that you just described, because we have come to think in that way, we see that as normal, and we get upset if we know somebody's in the house and they don't come to the door when we knock on their door. And we think we have the right to control other people.
Mm.
and even a responsibility to control other people, to make them do what we want them to do. You see it in our homes now. You see it horribly in our relationships.
Mm-hmm.
It's you know, NEI and I have coached, counseled, however people want to phrase it now, lots of couples. And one of the most overriding factors in terms of creating the problem is, and it's usually him, even though it's not always him, trying to control her, trying to make her think the way he thinks, trying to make her do things the way that he would do them, as if he is really the only person there.
Mm, right.
His job is to teach her how to be, you know, a person. And that's why a lot of people, I think, are really not understanding when they say, you know, you, not that you allow somebody to lead you, you what's the word for that when you, not suppress, not, where you allow someone to take control and guide the family. I just can't think of the term for that right now. But because of the nature of the culture, that has become problematic.
Mm-hmm.
For me, in two ways. Number one, you have to be, you know, a man to be able to do something like that. You have to have a sense of discipline. You have to have the model of being the kind of man that is a leader in that space. One of the reasons why I had such respect, adoration for Nana Malcolm X is that, you know, he could be fire in his lectures. He'd be fire outside.
Yeah.
He'd be fire and
yeah.
giving, you know, instructions
yes.
to the brothers mm-hmm. and the work that needed to be done. But when he walked into that house.
Right. He was, mild.
Yeah.
He was cool.
Yeah.
Yes.
That didn't go with him. Didn't go with him into the house. But we have, when you start combining that aggression with the sense of having to know everything or pretend to know everything, and with the idea that men are supposed to lead, but the leadership within this context doesn't require you to be of good character, doesn't require you to go and do the research to find out what needs to be done, where we need to go, how we need to do this. You know, you just have so many contradictions in the relationship. People get frustrated, and the children get confused. Because
mm-hmm.
they grew up thinking, I'm just supposed to be in charge. Doesn't make a difference if I don't have a job. Doesn't make a difference if I know nothing. Doesn't make, you know, any difference whatsoever. I'm just supposed to be in charge automatically because I'm the man. You know,
mm-hmm.
it's very interesting to me. You know, both of us have some decades on us, so we've been able to see change
mm-hmm.
occurring over time. And when I was young, you know, preteen, early teens, I watched my mom and dad. And in fact, in the neighborhood I grew up in, Woodridge in Washington, D.C., in the neighborhood where I grew up in this really three-square block area where I lived, I only knew three families where the father wasn't there. And in each one of these, you know, there was really a good reasonable excuse. One of the fathers had been killed in a train accident, and another one had transitioned. I forgot the other one, but, you know, there were
right.
there was good reasoning, and everybody understood, and everybody helped out. But I watched the relationship between the husbands and the wives in our community. And, I mean, I watched as a child. I've always loved watching, studying people, seeing their behavior. That's,
mm-hmm.
you know, I can sit for hours and hours and hours and just watch how people behave, how they act, given certain situations, conditions, what have you. And I watched the men and the women in our community who were married, and there was this division of labor between him and her. And it wasn't simply a division based upon, you know, she irons and she cooks and she washes the clothes, blah, blah, blah. It was a division based upon skill level. What he knew, he did. What he didn't know, he didn't do. What she knew, she did. What she didn't know, she didn't do.
Right.
And this division of labor I came to call domains, which was another major aspect of this.
Mm-hmm.
So I looked at my mom and my dad. My dad was, you know, 20-some-year military, Army, he was Ranger, all the rest of that stuff. And when it came to the security of the home, that was his domain. Mm-hmm. Whether it was how you lock the windows or how you bolted the windows or how you set up the gate or where the gate is going to be or what kind of dog we're going to get, all the rest of that. That was all his domain. And I never saw my mother argue with him about any of that. Mm-hmm. Now, I saw her ask for further clarification on certain things that he wanted done in a certain way relative to security, but I never saw her disagree or argue with him because that was his domain. And in the same way, when it came to how the children were going to be raised, the education, what we were supposed to learn, what books we were supposed to read, what summer classes we were supposed to be in, et cetera, that was her domain. And he didn't argue with that. He didn't question that whatsoever. He might also have asked for clarification on this point or this idea, what have you, but it wasn't a questioning, it wasn't a clarification that was questioning her authority mm-hmm. in this area, her authority in this domain. And I saw that in all of the major domains that are required to make, you know, a household, a house, a family, a home thrive. And I saw that in my neighbors' homes. I don't see that anymore.
Yeah, because they're single family.
Yes.
A woman-headed household.
I don't see that anymore. And even in families where both he and she is there, I don't see it like I did back then.
Mm-hmm.
It's more of a fight over claiming more of the other person's domain.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, it becomes pretty much null and void, like you said, when it's single parents, which has become the dominant form. Of course, we can't beat up on ourselves for that, which Europeans would have us do.
Mm-hmm.
People forget history. You look at traditional European society at the time that this country came into existence for them, when they were being shipped over here, the prostitutes off the streets, the folks come out of prison coming over here. This originally was a penal colony as far as I'm
right.
concerned, just like
exactly.
Australia, New Zealand.
Right.
But what you found over there was you had the same percentage of single female-headed families as you do in this country today. The same percentage of the population
mm-hmm.
of single female-headed families. So we're looking at this like this is something unique to black folk, or this is, you know, something unique to this country at this time. This has always been within European culture and society.
Mm-hmm. That's
single
right.
female families have always been the dominant life form. We talk about, you know, they'll talk about the good old days, you know, where you can walk down the street and not have to worry about leaving your door locked. That was us.
That was our village. Yeah, that was us.
I don't know. I was thinking about this the other week. I don't know of a time in history that I've read where you could walk down European streets safe and feel safe.
Right. Especially us.
I don't know of such a time.
Especially us. You know,
yeah.
if you were in their vicinity and
right.
you know, because of mm-hmm. the lawlessness that they've exhibited, particularly as
yes.
it pertained to us, you
yes.
know, boy, you yes. know, you out of your community, boy, where you going, you know?
Yes, yes, absolutely.
Fearful.
So it's the generalizations that we'll often make, you know, the oldest profession in the world, and I'll say whose world,
mm-hmm.
but all these generalizations that we make that have them at the center of the discussion, that have them at the center of the example, that have them defining these things for us, put it at a disadvantage and make us appear to be them, of course at a less powerful level, but make us appear to be them, make them the norm among us. And it's not changing them. They're not changing. You know, we're the ones who have changed. Now, they might be changing their image in the media to make them appear to be more human or more humane, et cetera, but we also should know that the image, that's what they've always been about, controlling the image. Machiavelli talked about that in The Prince.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you control your image to other people, and therefore you control them. You control how they see you. You
right.
control their fears.
Exactly.
You know, but it's, I guess, I know this program isn't about me, but I've been doing a lot of, not speculating, but thinking about why we have changed and the ways that we have changed lately. That conversation has been coming up with a lot of warriors why we're doing this, and I like it because if you understand why we're doing this or how we're doing this, then you can change it. Mm-hmm. You know, you and I grew up in a world where, and of course, I know you have years on me, but you and I grew up in a world where you did what you saw.
Mm-hmm.
And if you wanted to solve a problem, you were told, well, you go back, you have to find out the nature of the problem. You don't just start throwing Band-Aids on that bad boy. You go back to the nature of the problem if you want to solve it correctly, and we're not going back to the nature of the problem anymore. Wait, well, that's all passe. Who wants to talk about tradition? Who wants to talk about what happened way back when? We need to talk about now. Well, you can't. That's like dismissing not only Johnny Clark and the rest of these folks who made it clear. If you don't understand the history, if you don't understand the nature of those people, if you don't understand the nature of us, our people, then you cannot correctly apply a solution to any problem that we have. It's not possible. Mm-hmm. In order for you to apply a solution to whatever is going on in your home, whatever is going on in your community, whatever is going on in this world, you have to study some history. Okay, so why are we now seeing all of these black girls and black women disappearing by the thousands from our homes, from our communities, from our schools, from our movie theaters, from the amusement parks? Why are we seeing them disappear by the thousands? When you go back and you look at traditional European society, you understand exactly why it's going on. In addition to that, you have to derive from that in terms of their assault against us. You know, we're seen as food, however you want to define food. If you want to talk about in terms of something you chew, or you want to talk about something that your mind consumes, you know, we're still seen as food by them. We're just confused because they're smiling.
Mm-hmm.
We're just confused because they're allowing us to bed the daughters that they don't want anymore. You know, we're confused because we think that it's not rape if it's being done in your bed and you're married to this person. You know, that we forget the advantage of priority. It's easier to rape somebody if they're living with you. they're on the other part of the town.
Yeah.
You got a captive victim there. But because they're smiling at you and because they say that they love you, Bob, I think I could talk about this forever. The fakeness, the historical fakeness of Europeans, mm-hmm. and now the lies that are couched in smiles. I used to have to do that with the little ones. Haven't had to do it recently, but somebody who would bring the science of the normalness or the genetic origins of homosexuality like it's something normal and natural. And I said, okay, you know who we're dealing with. We're dealing with Europeans. We're dealing with European science. And we're following suit because we've been caught up in this nonsense as well. I said, but I look at him and I say, okay, if I was your friend, I'm sure I've done this on your program before, but mm-hmm. I would say to them, if I was your friend and been your friend for, 30, 40 years, and you knew that I was just a chronic liar, that I lied about everything, but mm-hmm. I was your friend, right. I was your dearest friend, but I lied to you about everything, and you knew me well enough to know that whenever I told you something is fact, you better go and investigate it for yourself.
Exactly, better check it.
And I said, so if I come to you now and I say, cross my heart, hand on the grave, what have you, my mom, blah, 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 I swear that I'm correct right now, would you believe me? And the students say, no. I said, so why are we believing Europeans now?
Thank you.
This is all that they've done to us.
Yeah.
But suddenly, because they're not their grandparents or great-grandparents or great-grandparents, even though we are our ancestors, somehow they're not theirs.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we're believing these lies because we don't want to do the research. We don't want to do the thinking. We don't want to be ostracized by our own for disagreeing with European culture, with disagreeing with the idea that European culture is ours, by disagreeing with them in saying that African culture is different than African culture. But that's what the heart and soul of what those major thinkers and researchers did for us, help us understand Jobe's two cradle theory. Okay, Jomo Kenyatta, when he talked about the difference between the European and African educational system,
mm-hmm.
at the heart, what was the difference at the heart? Not in terms of difference in terms of how you write your letters or how you write your numbers, but the difference in the mentality toward the idea of education, what education actually meant to Africans versus what it meant to Europeans. Mm-hmm. So all of that is like dust in the wind. Because we think that we're one. We think that all everybody is one, you know, people.
Humanity, yeah, one humanity. And that's the idea that the Caucasian has impounded upon us. Although they don't believe it, they believe that they are superior. In fact, we have no humanity as far as they're concerned. Still today, in many of the thought processes of those who are in positions of power or those in politics, those in religion, and so forth. Yes.
Mm-hmm. And they look at you like you were crazy for saying that.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, and it doesn't make a difference. We often forget, you know, the politics of science. The science is politics. You know, the mm-hmm. questions asked, the answers sought, they follow the interests of the people who originate the questions or the culture that originates the questions. So we forget that that's the basis of all the truth that we operate in. That we operate on, you know, and it's, I guess the saddest part for me is that, you know, you're seeing more and more going into academia, more and more students going to, our children going into grad school, and they're operating even more firmly on the assumption that European science is the best science possible, that it's not political,
mm-hmm.
and that science is self-correcting. That if you just keep pursuing science, you know, with this objective frame of mind without any bias, that somehow magically the correct answer or the finding is going to come out correct and it's not going to follow anybody's politics. He's still alive. There's a brother who I entered grad school with. His name was Jimmy. And Jimmy was from, where was Jimmy from? Jimmy was from New Mexico. And Jimmy was very, 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 very intelligent. I'd say for me, as far as I was concerned, he was like a genius level. He was the only other brother who came in. We were the only two brothers in the sociology department at the University of Chicago for like a 6-8 year stretch.
Mm.
And I really admired him because he read everything. He would come back, he and his wife, who, you know, she wasn't going to school, but she was able to practice her art. They would go to the library, you know, every week and a half, and he'd come back with two shopping carts. She could have one shopping cart, he'd have the other shopping cart full of books. And at the University of Chicago, the Regenstein Library, you can check out books and keep them for decades, as long as, you know, you're still a student there.
Oh, okay.
So Jimmy, you know, you can imagine what his apartment looked like. But Jimmy believed in science. He believed in its that it had a self-correcting nature within European society. He believed that if he could just show Europeans the truth, and this is why I learned that lesson through watching him and what they did to him. He believed that if he could just show them the humanity of African people, he firmly believed this. He was a sociology major just like me, so we were in pretty much everything together. He believed that he could use science to correct them and elevate them. He read, you know, Chancellor Williams. He'd read everything by us. He scared them so badly in terms of his understanding of European philosophy. In terms of the sociology of education, he scared them. Not just, you know, they were like a little leery of him. No, he scared them because of his intelligence. So this guy, Jimmy, I said, as far as I'm concerned, I don't have an ego in this area. He was smarter than me. He had read much, much more than me.
mm-hmm.
Both of us came in to the University of Chicago on the same fellowship. It was a 3-year fellowship. I took a year off to go study that's a long story, but I took a year off to study. When I came back, he was taking his what are called preliminary exams. And those exams are where you move from your master's to your doctorate, the doctorate program. Jimmy Shiner had failed two of his three exams. He had to go back, restudy, and take them over again, and they finally allowed him to give them. I went in and took them and passed all three of them on the first try. When it was time for Jimmy, once he had passed that second set, he went to, you had to create, your dissertation committee, three faculty members. Jimmy couldn't find three to be on his council, to be on his dissertation council. I was able to immediately find three easily. They didn't give Jimmy a second fellowship. They gave me another one, a different one that covered my next 3 years there. They didn't give him one. They wouldn't give him any money. His father second mortgaged his home to pay for a few more years for Jimmy to be there. Mm. They would not let him proceed. He was still there. He was still a student, still reading. They would not let him proceed. And it got to a point when I left the University of Chicago to come and teach at Morehouse. The year that I left, they gave him what's called a terminal master's. A terminal master's means we're giving you this master's, but we don't want you to proceed in the program towards your doctorate. All graduate schools, you don't have terminal master's. But the worst thing for that for Jimmy, and I saw it break his spirit, the worst thing for Jimmy was that this meant that he couldn't pursue a doctorate in sociology anywhere. Not just the University of Chicago, anywhere. He would not be allowed in the program because wherever he went, he'd have to have a transcript sent to them from the University of Chicago, and on that transcript, it would say terminal master's. So this man believed, and he scared the living daylights out of them.
Mm-hmm.
The last time I saw him was when I went to defend my dissertation, and I passed by the married student housing, and he was sitting at a table reading, and I walked up to him kind of at an angle. And I said, "Hey, Jimmy," and he seemed like he almost jumped out of his skin. He was that frazzled by them breaking him, not letting him move forward, not letting him, pursue his knowledge.
Mm-hmm.
So, for me, that was really an eye-opener. I really hadn't given it a lot of thought before, Jimmy and I sit there and have a lot of conversations. I hadn't really given it much thought. I didn't assume that science was objective, completely and totally objective, and that it was self-correcting. I just didn't give it a lot of thought. I didn't care. He did. But he was an example at this, liberal, supposed to be liberal, European Jewish-funded institution. And he, because he was so brilliant and didn't, kneel to them, he didn't, he wasn't arrogant at all. But because he didn't kneel to them and didn't back down with what he knew, they found ways to block his every move and to finally remove him from the institution.
Mm-hmm.
So I said, there's some intent there. This is supposed to be science. We're supposed to be scientists. We're supposed to be developing into scientists who, you're supposed to carve the world for the world. You're supposed to come up with theoretical understandings of everything that allows, people to live as human beings and all the rest of this mess.
Mm-hmm.
But in that science, they found a threat. They found a threat from an African, from a black man, that scared them to death.
Mm-hmm. That they got to control.
And they removed that threat. And he wasn't the only person who I saw them do that to. And this is, for those who know the University of Chicago, it's going to be this, liberal, we love everybody type institution.
Mm-hmm.
But underneath that, everywhere, we find that, that was the point I wanted to make. That reminded me of Socrates, where Socrates came down to the Hermetic Mystery System.
Yeah, he studied in Kemet, then he goes back to Greece.
And didn't make it very far within the Comedic Mystery System. He didn't make it all the way to the top.
Okay.
And then he started teaching that African stuff.
Right.
and the Greek said, "No, that's not us. You can't do that." He didn't stop, so they gave him that choice.
That's right.
Either we kill you or you commit suicide.
Yep.
You're not bringing that African stuff here.
Mm-hmm. Made him drink him
You're not incorporating spirit into how we interpret reality. Mm-hmm. Which, of course, a lot of people need to, I think, understand that European science is bereft. There's a complete and total absence of any spiritual analysis within European science. They're trying to pretend, starting to try to pretend now. But if you incorporate spirit into there, then you're incorporating an analysis of righteousness. You're incorporating an analysis of Ma'at. And you can't do that within European history, European sociology, any of the social sciences in particular, because then it's going to show Europeans for exactly what they are.
Exactly. Exactly.
And they can't have that. Mm-hmm. They can't have that. Yeah. So it's the and we know, of course, for our ancestors, spirit was the heart of science. Mm-hmm. Spirit was the heart of all social, cultural, academic analysis. That was the heart and soul, and remains the heart and soul of those who are still thinking as our ancestors would have us think. It's at the heart and soul of everything. But that's not, this is not African society. The people in this society don't follow any African traditions except maybe superficially to give the image of being righteous. You know, I made a meme one time, a picture of, I guess it was about maybe three or four Europeans doing meditation. Mm-hmm. And I essentially said, this is the image of a people who have essentially destroyed the planet and have done everything in their power to keep peace from everybody else on the planet, trying to find some peace for themselves in the midst of their destruction of the world. So you get this image, and you're looking at the meditation. It's not about the world. It's about them finding their little individual peace. And if they say otherwise, then it's because they're trying to control image. They're trying to control the image that other people have of them. This guy, Irving Goffman, who was a sociologist before our time, way back when, not way back when, but a while back, who came up with a number of sociological terms, and one of them was impression management, and he described this, and there wasn't any argument within sociology about this, but he called it impression management. It's simple, two simple words, impression management, where within European culture society, the norm for people is for you to assess what other people, what you want other people to see in you, and you want to control how they look at you and how they see you. So you say those things and move in that way that make them think that, even if it's the complete and total opposite of you. That's what my room was talking about with the Asili and rhetorical ethic. Mm-hmm. When they've gone around the world, and before they did their serious damage, they studied the people to see what they were morally like, what their ethics were like, what their values were. And they studied that, and they mimicked that. So that those people became confused, if you will, just like what's going on now with us. They became confused and thought that the Europeans were the same as them. And once this was done, then the Europeans would come in and destroy it like they had originally planned to do. But they needed to disarm those people mm-hmm. first.
Right.
You know, and that's that. Now we're like in the upper stages of that. You know, the greatest indicator to me of menticide involves the bedroom. Mm. Either you are sleeping with them or you are practicing their sexual behaviors. Mm-hmm. When you've reached the point where you are imitating your destroyer's sexual behaviors, that's the farthest that you can go. You've reached the lowest possible point where they're now controlling your most private, your most secretive, if you will, practices. It's different, you know, if you sit the same way they do in the classroom, or you walk the same way as they do in it, or you talk the same way as they do, which is scary for me now. Whole other stories about that in grad school. But when you are doing what they're doing in the bedroom, then you are them, as far as you're concerned. You are them. You have become them. They don't need to do any other work on you. They don't need to, you know, enforce anything. They don't need to, because you're lost. And you have no way of finding your way back, and you would kill somebody who tried to take you back.
Mm-hmm.
Because you know that this is the norm for Europeans, which means it's the norm for you, which means that it's the only human way to behave. You're completely and totally lost. And I wish that I had the, not the money, but the inclination. And I'm very sure I could find some assistance to do the research, but I wish I could do research that would make these things obvious in studies, but they, of course, would never get published. And they would immediately be denounced. And saying, you know, he's just crazy. He just doesn't like us.
Sure.
You know, which, yeah. Of course, that's true as well, but still, that wouldn't be the point.
Right.
But we can't do that. It's just like you need an audience of tens of thousands of us to force them to listen to what's being said so that it begins to incubate in their brains. I remember this revolutionary say in the 80s when he was asked what kind of government would we need to have as African people to, you know, return African people to being themselves. And he said, you need a tyranny, a totalitarian state, because people would have to be made to be African, mm-hmm. at least in terms of their actions, before it would begin to make sense, before they could incorporate it. I'm not totally in agreement with that, but I understood his logic.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we're so far away from what it means to be African.
African, exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And all of these voices, all of the Negroes, all the lost souls out here who are in the vanguard of Eurocentrism.
Mm-hmm. They are.
You know, in our community.
They are.
Yeah. It's, and Bobby, you know where we live.
Yeah.
And, you know, Akubin, of course, was in our house.
Mm-hmm.
And when Akubin was started, I guess it was maybe 2 or 3 years after we got started,
mm-hmm.
our neighbor, who was, interestingly, he had been a Clark Atlanta professor, our neighbor called the city on us. He called the city of Atlanta on us. He knew what we were doing,
mm-hmm.
and he knew that, you know, they couldn't necessarily do anything because we weren't in the books as a school business, but he knew that something was wrong.
Okay.
He couldn't put his finger on it. But he saw African attire, he saw, you know, license plates with, you know, Rasta on the front of it, and Africa on the front of it, and people with natural hair.
Mm-hmm.
He knew something was wrong. He couldn't tell you what it was in a million years.
Yeah.
But he knew something was wrong, and he knew that he had a personal responsibility to destroy it. I say, luckily for us, the office where he called, there was a guy down the street who didn't like him, and he had retired from the office, and the sister who took in the complaint, she called him to find out what's going on, and he you know.
Okay.
So it came to naught. He couldn't do anything anyway because technically we're not a school.
Right.
You know. but the idea when you know, we park our car someplace and a African sees the front of the car, it's like they'll almost breakneck speed to turn their head away from that picture of Africa, or they'll read the sticker on the back about Kwanzaa, you know, we honor our ancestors, and they frown up because they know that something is wrong with that. It's like, well, why would he need to say that? Why would he need to put a sticker on that, on his car? We love all our white ancestors. we honor our ancestors.
Yeah.
You know.
Well, listen, I want to take a break, and when we come back from the break, there's a lot of callers, people in the queue that I want to ask you some questions and so forth. Also, too, I want to talk to you about the upcoming healing event that Mama Ya talked about, you know, with brothers and sisters together, July 20th. We want to talk about that. And any other things. I know there's a AfriCorps where brothers and sisters, if you got chores that need to be done around your house and you need somebody to help you with them, there's a handy hands Atlanta that can assist with that. And let me know and talked about your involvement with that. And any other things that we want to talk about, my brother. So we're going to take a break. And when we come back from the break, we'll get off into more discussion. Baba Moali Mubarudi is our guest. It's always a pleasure and an honor to have him. You know, believe me, he's a treasure for us, brothers and sisters. You're listening to African Perspectives here on the Motherland Media Network on timeforanawakening.com and blacktalkradionetwork.com. We'll be right back. You stay with us.
You are listening to African Perspectives with host Brother Oshie on Time for an Awakening Media, part of the Black Talk Radio Network. For podcasting or live program scheduling, hit them up at timeforanawakening@gmail.com.
Down in a breeze, brothers with their afros taking center stage, watching as this culture slowly comes of age with a mind of its own. Yeah, mothers out in the yard hanging up her clothes, fathers playing with the kids, keeping them on the go. Neighborhoods beating on the heart of its soul. And that's where my feelings live. Cause I love my people. The way they let it go on the dance floor. Ain't nobody gonna do it like us, no. I'm loving my people. Table. My heart's full of love, spirits in the flow, and I'm loving my people. Teachers off in the classroom giving up the love, supported by that mom and dad who want that special touch. Little acts of kindness prove to mean so much when we give what we know. Kitchen pots are banging, smell of soul food fills the air. You walk past the neighbor's house wishing you had dinner there. Better times for living when people seem to care about that place where they grow. That's why I love my people. The way they let it go on a dance floor. Nobody gonna do it like us, no. I'm loving my people. Said I love my people. I love. So from the stove straight to the kitchen table. My heart's full of love, spirits in the flow. And I'm loving my people. Gather at the church early Sunday morn. Openly they sing and praise and gospel music's born. God gave us love enough with spirits free to run. Why can't we learn to love ourselves like we're the chosen ones? Come and let me know how your life is doing good. Tell me how the blessings flow through the neighborhood. Share with me that time of feelings understood in that place we call home. Cause I love my people. The way they let it go on the dance floor. Ain't nobody gonna do it like us, no. I'm loving my people. So that I'm loving my.
soul from the stove straight to the kitchen table. My heart's full of love, spirits in the flow, and I'm loving my people. Kitchen table. Can't nobody do it like us now. I'm loving my people. Say that I'm loving my. I love. I'm loving my.
You are listening to Time for an Awakening Media, part of the Black Talk Radio Network. For podcasts or live programming, hit them up at timeforanawakening.com.
Welcome back, brothers and sisters. Once again, you're listening to African Perspectives here on the Motherland Media Network on timeforanawakening.com and blacktalkradionetwork.com. Our guest, and it's always an honor and a pleasure to have Baba Mwalimu Baruti. And I tell you, there's no brother who speaks on and articulates the need for African sovereignty than Baba Baruti. And I appreciate you, brother.
I appreciate you as well, Baba, since day one.
Yeah.
Since you dragged me up to Milwaukee. Many years ago.
That's right. Man, that was a long time ago.
Yeah,
I think that was in the 90s, man, the late 90s, man. Mm-hmm. My sister, my dear friend, Queenie Fama, man. Beautiful sister.
Yes. Man. Miss her.
Yep, definitely.
Strong.
Yeah. There's a number of us, we're not the mass of us, unfortunately, but there's a mm-hmm. number of us that, and we're true to it, we're sincere about it, we're committed to it, mm-hmm. we've been saying these things for decades, and we'll continue to say them, we'll continue to do them, we'll continue to be the example. One thing that I was very honored by when Baba, Brother Mariba Kelsey, said to me, says, one thing that I noticed, and since you've been here, you've been consistent. You've mm-hmm. been on it. And I just felt really good about that, man, coming from such an esteemed elder as him, mm-hmm. recognizing
it's him. That's a major statement if it came from, somebody who's just coming in this direction. But you said, to come from someone like him.
Yeah, definitely. Man. So
it's major.
Yep. And so, I'm going to stay on this case and, continue to promote independence, self-determination, liberation, and sovereignty for African people. The model of this program is Pan-Africanism or perish, unify or die. And that's the deal, man, because my contention is that I envision even though it's so far off, but I envision a world where we, as African men and women, are controlling ours.
Absolutely.
And to me, the continent is where we need to be, because that is ours, and we don't have to ask anybody for permission. We don't have to ask anybody for their help or whatever. To me, there's a thing with Africans on the continent, and Africans throughout the diaspora say, hey, you know what? I'm tired of chasing this cracker. This is over. Mm-hmm. Let us come home. Let us embrace one another. Let us work with one another, trust, and build with one another. We have all that we need. The only thing that we don't have is our right mm-hmm. minds. We right. don't have the mind that could help us develop what we did thousands of years ago. And I ain't saying mm-hmm. what we need to do is thousand years ago, because what we did thousand years ago was so outstanding, a lot of it's still there to be studied and to be mimicked, but that's what we need to do, man, because you know, putting our hands, I mean, putting our lives in the hands of these crackers. I mean, you know, you hip to this cracker, and I played it last week, Howard Nicholas.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, yeah, where he says that, you know, Africa must never be able to publish anything, build anything, produce anything. Africa must be remain poor so we can get their resources at a very low cost or free or whatever. And then there was another group says, you know, we need to depopulate the planet. Too many people on the planet. We want to get rid of at least about 3 billion people. And we're going to start with Africa because they're deplorable. They're not part of the world economy. So we're going to start with Africa. We're going to go ahead and eliminate them. You know, these are, Baba Baruti, these are declarations of war.
Yes.
You know, shit.
They're not mentioning words.
No, they're not. They're saying they're we're going to eliminate you. We're going to kill you.
Mm-hmm. And even if they don't say it, you know, there's that undercurrent.
Yeah.
Where they're moving in that direction. It never stopped.
Yes.
The scramble for Africa never stopped.
Never stopped.
COINTELPRO has never stopped.
Mm-hmm.
And COINTELPRO was something before COINTELPRO.
Yeah.
You know, it just became formalized.
And
government organization.
And our problem is that those of us who are saying this to our brothers and sisters, they don't believe us. Because
nope.
They don't want to believe us. They want to believe that they can make the Caucasian, the European, the Urugu, you know, appeal to their moral nature. That this is much as ours as it is theirs.
Yeah.
You know.
But you have no power here.
You have none.
No decision making, no anything.
None.
Because you said if the economy fell apart right now in our face in a big way, the company, the corporation that you work for, that you're supposed to be part of, and everybody's family, you get nothing.
Mm-hmm.
You get nothing but a pink slip. The money's going to be, if it's going to be divided up, if it's going to be divvied up, it's going to be between them.
Yeah.
We'll have no say. Or, you know, they might include Negro here, Negro there to make sure that we can't say, you know, complete and total racism.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, it's you watch the efforts to fragment our truth.
Mm-hmm.
And you've had the development of a mentality among young folks. Somebody needs to trace this, because you have a development among the young folk of the idea that success or being somebody or what have you is a result of you destroying any of the logic that came before you. So you have people who are trying to undermine and say Francis Crest Welsing didn't know what she's talking about.
Mm-hmm.
You know, college students, freshmen, sophomores, wanting to argue with Mama Rimba about, you know, the Asili and all the rest of this. So it's like a lot of them base, because that's the way of this reality now for us. The ability for you to rise, to be somebody, is you have to step on somebody else. That's part of the deal. And if you want to become an intellectual, an arguer, a debater, if you will, online or anywhere else, you have to find somebody who has been at it, who has done the work, and target their work and try to destroy what they have said. And then you become somebody because you, if you will, collect their wealth and you add on to it. That's the whole, I mean, that's what I'm constantly seeing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there wasn't enslavement. Africans weren't enslaved. They come up with all the rest of this yang. The world is flat, all the rest of that stuff. All this is coming based upon arguing. There's no new scholarship. There's no new intellectual exercises of worth. It's just you finding something that people have believed for good reason and find a way to make people believe that it's not true because of your, you know, your charisma or what have you. That's it. You know, even some of the young folk who are looking at it, you know, they're saying the exact same thing. But it ends up being a situation where we get more destroyed, not only because of the loss of potential warriors, but because we get fragmented more and more and more and more, and it gets to a point where there's no such thing as what it means to be African because there are so many arguments out there.
Right.
So anybody is correct. If I say African, being African means being European, then, you know, it's good, it's cool, because, you know, it's you. You're an individual.
That's right.
It's breaking us up into such teeny tiny pieces that is virtually, nothing's impossible, but it's virtually impossible for us to come together as a people because there are so many divisions amongst us.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we know how it started out, but now it's reached a point where it's like you can look at us and say, we'll never get together. Like I said, I don't believe that.
I don't either.
You know, we'll never get together because of the fragmenting.
Yeah, I don't either. But, I mean, it's going to be difficult in this environment because this is a European environment, and their whole thing is individualism, materialism, greed, and violence. That's what they're all about. And that's what they've always been about. And unfortunately, we follow suit because we want to be like them. We want to share in this damn madness.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. Now, Amos Wilson warned us about that.
Yeah.
We need to remove them from power, not try to get what they have or be like them. We need to remove them from power.
Exactly.
And that's the only way. When you're talking about, when you say this Pan-Africanism, Africa motherland is the center where we have sovereignty, that's the only way.
Yeah, I'm sorry
that's
to scream.
The only possible way.
It is. It's the only possible way that as I've looked at this over a number of years, saying to myself, there is no other way but this way. There is no other way. But yet, it's something that we are afraid to embrace. We're afraid to deal with it. We're afraid to talk about it. Well, number one, because the European has instilled fear in us. Because one of the things that we kind of know that, you know, as I've always said, Europeans have always found a better way to kill your ass, you know. And they have multiple ways to destroy you from overt to clandestine. You know, you've been in the service, you know how that operates. Yeah. Let me take some callers here, Baba Baruti. We have a number of people who've been waiting. If you want to join this conversation, for those who are already in the queue, hit star twice, and you can have some conversation with Baba Mwalimu Baruti. Brother Irv, how you doing?
I'm good, Baba Oshie. Thank you for taking my call. Baba Rudy, thank you. That's all I can say. You have said some things that I've written down. I'm not lying. When you speak, I write. Like the guy said, I debate with my equals, others I teach. And brother, you're teaching me today. You're teaching me, and I wrote down the spirit of capitalism. I'm going to get that book. But I speak to young people. My son is 21, so I spoke to his friends. They really respect me, but they don't understand me a lot because they are. And I told them one day, and I should have never said this. I said, "You are a people with no history," and they swallowed that. I said, I explained it to them. I said, "Your history did not start here at this country where the slaves were. Your history did not start 100,000 years ago. It started over 200,000 years ago. You go all the way back." I said, it's all written. But the brother asked me something, and I wanted to ask you this. He said, why did James Brown make that song, "I'm Black and I'm Proud"? And that set my mind into a spiral because I said, why doesn't the Mexicans write a song, "I'm Mexican and I'm Proud. I'm Latino, I'm proud. I'm German, I'm proud"? Why did he feel at that time he had to write a song to let somebody know that he was proud of his skin color? Because that's what he was talking about. I'm Black and I'm proud. Why? I said, because you got to understand, you were being conditioned in the 60s. Well, they didn't understand that. But back then, we were being conditioned to be what we are now. You said something, brother, that took me somewhere when you said, once the Caucasian gets in your bedroom,
mm-hmm.
it's pretty much a wrap at that point.
Yes.
Because now you're talking about my reproductive thing. You know, I'm producing children with this Urugu. And yep. what are my children going to be? They're going to be torn. Mm-hmm. They're going to be torn. They live a double consciousness out the gate. Some of us didn't get a double consciousness until we got grown. Or two months of school. These children yeah. are going to have a double consciousness, as Marcus Garvey spoke about, out the gate in the incubator. They don't know where to put them, with the black children or the white children or the red children. We don't know. And then they're totally confused in this domination. I call it a domination thing, where white folks, they let you watch sports where this team got to beat that team. So when you get in life, I got to be better than you. We can't work together. This is a competition, brother. I'm out. I got to get you. I got to be better. White folks got to love me more than they love you. And that way I'll have a great life and you'll be terrible. And this is how they want us to think. But I'm reading a book. I don't have the book in front of me. I wish I did. It was forwarded by brother, what is the brother, Renoco. He forwarded the book. Yeah. He forwarded the book. And it goes all the way back. And it's a really interesting book on how we, as African people, we didn't think like the European thinks. The whole domination thing. I got to have a dog in the house and I got to be in charge of something. We all thought as a village, as a community. And if I can do something to help you, I'll help you. And you know what? You said something. I'm going to stop after this, Bob Osh. You know, I can talk forever. But he said something about speaking. When I was growing up in West Baltimore, a brother used to come up the street and he said, man, you know, I came up the street and so-and-so didn't even speak to me. And I was like, what's wrong with him? But then I realized you're right. That was, to him, that was a declaration of war. You didn't like me because you just didn't say, hey, how you doing? And you looked right at me. He looked right at me and ain't say nothing. Huh? And then I understood that's a sign of respect. That's a sign you respect that brother. I respect you, man, because I do it now. I acknowledge. I said something the other day, and I'm, after this, I'm gone. I'm really gone. I said something the other day. I'm in L.A. right now, and I said this. I saw some. You see very few black people in L.A. You think you would, but you don't. And I saw some black people, and I said, hey, black people, how y'all doing? Oh, they thought that was hilarious. Oh, they started laughing. So you can't call us black around these white people. We're not black. We're not, and they were. It seemed like they were ashamed of who they were. To me, I could have been taking it wrong. But I'm like, brother, we all Africans. I don't care where you are. You're gonna be. If you don't think you African, they gonna call you African. So you might as well wake up and see who you are and what you represent. Because just walking in the room, you change the dynamic. Just like when the tall hats, when the Jew comes in, he changes everything when he walks in the room. So no, brother. I can listen to you all day, and you haven't said one thing that I can push back on and say, man, that man don't know what he's talking about, man. Hey, why don't you get somebody else on here, please? Somebody want to hear that? Brother, thank you, brother. You're an inspiration to me. You're filling my tanks. Like I said, Oshie, I got to get my tanks filled every now and then because they get low. You get low. But I'm African today, tomorrow, and the next day. Right thank on. You so much. Thank you for coming on. Brother Oshie, we'll talk.
All right, peace. Brother. Peace.
Peace. I appreciate that. And I was just thinking about what he said about James Brown. Of course, it's a major statement when you have to say that.
Mm-hmm.
But it was also just a function of the time.
Right.
Everybody at that time was coming out with something. O.J., Schiphol Hoard, you know, mm-hmm. everybody was coming out.
Yeah.
With something having to do because it became popular for that moment.
Mm-hmm.
The most telling thing for me was what happened afterward. It disappeared. It completely mm-hmm. and totally disappeared. It went back to business as usual.
Yep.
For that fleeting moment, man,
we got a dash of pride. We got a dash of collectiveness.
Yes.
You know, we call each other brother and sister. You know, we have to, you know, but.
Put some signs on the store saying this is black owned, et cetera, et cetera. The black student unions, I really looked at the black student unions, where they were formed as a result of the levels of racism on these predominantly white campuses. But as soon as the white folks started saying, you know, we love you, those black student unions became dismantled. They fell apart.
Because they gave us the illusion of inclusion, you know. the perception that somehow we're going to be fair and everybody will be treated fairly, righteously, and you can participate too, you know, you will be valued, your opinions and your,
no. It's the same thing for me as the logic of when we walk into one of these hair and nail shops and we get followed around. Mm-hmm. But as soon as we turn around in anger and that person smiles at us, we're completely and totally disarmed. We're completely and totally disarmed. The same thing, academia, the same everywhere. Yeah. They have learned we want validation by them or anybody who we see as having more power, anybody who we see is better than us or greater than us. We want their validation so bad, they can do all kinds of whatever to us. They can shoot us. They can, you know, rape us. They can do whatever they want to. But as long as in the end, at some point in time, they smile at us, we know we're okay.
Man. It's just like Malcolm said, we've been duped, hoodwinked, you know, led astray, man. Because, you know, and now when you look at our community, everybody's in our community, and they're making the money. It doesn't matter if it's Baltimore, Atlanta, L.A., wherever it is, they're in control. You got the Koreans and so forth dominating the hair care products, you know, dominating them.
In the county with the wealthiest or the highest income Africans in this country, Prince George's County.
Yeah,
it's
Maryland.
The same thing.
In Maryland, doesn't
same
make
thing.
A difference. See?
Yeah.
So
it doesn't change. It doesn't change as long as our minds don't change.
That's right.
As long as we don't see a better way of doing it. As long as we see them as the heroes, as the brilliance, as long as we see them as having the power that we may aspire to, as long as we see them as our center, as the center of all of our aspirations, then it's not going to change. Everybody who comes through is going to see it, use us as a doormat. To get into the house.
That's right.
And we're still going to be sitting outside as a springboard to get them into the house. As long as we don't see African people as one and becoming powerful. And we also make the mistake of assuming that in order for us to see each other as one, we have to like each other.
No, we don't.
I don't know any people.
No.
Any people, everybody likes each other. But we have to see ourselves as one people and fight accordingly.
Right. Right. See us as a collective, you know.
Yes.
Individualism is a European Urugu desire. I think, therefore I am, you know.
Yes.
But collectivism is an African imperative. It is a must. It is who we are historically and culturally. Look at us as a people, you know, us being together, you know. So
obviously that communalism doesn't hurt us in terms of our genius. And, of course, Europeans would have us think that, but if it hurt us in our genius, then what we did couldn't have been done.
Right. We got another caller. Jay, good afternoon.
Hotep, Oshi, Hotep, Baba, how are you?
Great, my brother. How you doing?
Good. Listen, right quick, whatever happened to that brother Jimmy? You were talking about that, I think it's what, Chicago University or Chicago State?
He went back home. He and his wife and their son went back home. She's an artist there. I have no idea what I know he's there. I don't know what happened to him. I reached out, you know, a couple times, but I think it's a shame because that was all he ever wanted. That was all he saw. That was if he couldn't do that, he couldn't do anything. So, you know, his whole existence was wrapped around getting his doctorate from the University of Chicago. So it's a shame that you know he's essentially gone into hiding for the rest of his life, if you will.
Well, you know, they probably pegged it. They probably saw it. And, you know, knowing the nature of them, they determined they wasn't going to allow it to happen for him to be able to move forward. And unfortunately, we don't have the type of cadre or the people to surround them to move them forward and maybe not get it from there. And even with the wickedry that they did for not letting them go someplace else, he could go to another country and get it. You know, yeah. I'm just at the point now to where it's not about here no more. You know, the young people that I'm mentoring right now, the first thing I tell them is you got to start looking beyond America, man. You got to start learning basics of other languages and other countries and try to figure out what you're going to do with your life, not totally dependent upon being here. And, you know, I got a young brother now that I've been working with for the last 8 years. He's a welder. He's been all over the world making hundreds of thousands of dollars. Okay. 26 years old.
Okay.
And, you know, the thing is, like I said to him 8 years ago, man, you don't have the ability or you're not going to apply yourself to go to college and do that. So you don't want to get yourself in debt. Go out there and find you a trade.
Mm-hmm.
He tried plumbing. He didn't really like that too much. But then he tried welding. And let me tell you something, man. He's probably one of the most successful 26 years olds that I know that have seen the world. I mean, his passport is what I'm so proud of because he's been on numerous continents just welding. I mean, just came back from Saudi Arabia on a $150,000 6 month deal.
Oh wow!
You know what I mean?
Yes.
Numerous languages, and you know I use them right now as an example with all of the kids that I try to talk to and explain to them that we at war because you know, Baba. This is real, and you know this better than anybody, and I always look for your leadership in regard to this.
Okay.
We're in danger and don't even realize we're in danger.
Right.
We don't understand this is a white man's country, and this country ain't never going to do nothing for our African survival. And it seems to me, as I get older, we are more embedded in loving this devil than anything. Loving and protecting the interests of this country who it gotten to the point now to where anytime you can put out front Agenda 47 and Project 2025 in the open, then something fundamentally wrong with you as a African if you don't even realize you got to place yourself in a position to survive because you're really facing death. And I'm not talking about voting for a Republican or a Democrat because the reality is this, which most don't understand. If Biden get back in the office, there's going to be certain parts of that agenda that's going to come into play, that's going to affect your life. So what thing are we not realizing that we're in danger? Because believe me, these Negro peens don't think we're in danger at all. This is not a game. So I don't know. But
right.
Lastly, let me say this to you, Baba. When we last spoke on Carl Nelson's show, you made a comment, and I've been thinking about this comment since you made it, about in order for us to move forward, we're going to have to come together in small groups and educate the babies. And you know something, Baba, since you made that statement, I realized, and the only reason I say I realize it is because I've been doing this for over 35 years. I have met most of our scholars. I've had breakfast with Dr. Ben. I took a class in college with Dr. Clark. I was a member of ASCAT. I was involved with First World. So I've seen them all.
Okay.
Amos Wilson, I worked for. I've seen them all. So I know what the deal is. And I'm telling you this, Baba.
Mm-hmm.
From the 80s to today, mm-hmm. culturally, we have regressed. And the only reason I say that is because in the 80s, we were studying the works of our scholars
mm-hmm.
and our intellectuals. Then they hit us with the drugs. They hit us with the garbage romance novels and all of the other sickness that then came into play to now we don't even dress culturally. You see what I'm saying? So what I'm trying to say is what you said is the key to how we may survive who have an African understanding. And it's going to be the babies. Because if you notice, every 25 to 30 years, mm-hmm. the cycle changes on a certain level. And maybe this time, when the cycle changes, if it does in our lifetime, the babies will be ready to pick up the mantle and move us forward as Africans.
All right, brother. Thanks a lot, Jay. Appreciate you.
Thank you.
All right.
They gotta know.
Yeah.
And that's something I've been saying now for, I don't know, maybe 15 years mm-hmm. in, you know, small settings. Where if you're not organizing at that level, understanding that if you're visible, your Urugu's coming to tear it down.
Mm-hmm.
You know, for to learn from history. That's supposed to be the purpose. So we know how to do whatever it is that we need to do and do it better. And if we've learned nothing else, we know that if you're visible, they're going to automatically send in one of
right.
us or find a way themselves
mm-hmm.
to take it out. No one has shown me where I'm wrong yet. I'm not, you know, I don't know everything, but I haven't seen or heard anyone tell me, no, that's not what they've been doing.
Shit. No, that's strictly what they've been doing. That's
yeah.
out of dominance and control. Let me take mm-hmm. this caller.
Okay.
Brother Paul, good afternoon. Brother Paul. All right, I'll come back to you. All right. Once again, there's a number of you. If you hit star twice, you can join this conversation. Hit star twice, you can join the conversation. All right, here's Brother Paul. Brother Paul.
Can you hear me?
Yes, we can hear you.
I don't know what happened there. I apologize. But let me just get straight to the point, Baba Olchi, and good afternoon to your guest. You know, a lot of thoughts were going from my brain. I want you to try and address some of these thoughts here. I'm a conscious observer of our people on the planet, not just in the country I was born, but everywhere. And through this technology, through the internet, you can do that. You can do that quite diligently. And I think this is just my personal observation. I feel that there are, although, like a sister said on this platform, we have more in common than we have differences. I'm not sure I agree with that, to be honest with you. I don't think, personally, the evidence for me points to that. When I listen to these platforms, I look on the internet and the interactions I've been in, time I've spent in the US, time I've spent in Canada, my parents' place of birth, Jamaica, and then on the African continent. We have a lot of indifferences, many indifferences. It's complexing to me how people say, like, we talk in this fashion, we're all African, as if we're African and we're the same. We're not. We're definitely not. Even in the place I'm born. The dynamics between America and the UK, I have grown up with people from Igbo, Yoruba, Caribbean, Jamaica. So I've grown with these people from infant, you know, and I recognize the different dynamics. Dynamics in the US is the same. It's just not the same. Even speak today, you everything is American, African, or African American. And I don't think you realize that we don't speak like that. Like, for instance, you will never hear no one here say, I'm British, Jamaican, or Jamaican. But, and I wonder why that term is always defined. I have to be African American. Why is that always necessarily defined? I'm guessing it's based on your history. I'm guessing it's based on the fact that you had a system of apartheid run down from government. It's the same system which is set up in South Africa. That's where they got it from, America. And I similar patterns which go on in South Africa with this protectionism, which go on in America. Similar, like the rejection of Africans on in South Africa, with these groups who've been formed to reject other Africans. The same thing's going on in the US, like with ADOS and things like that. I think it comes from this apartheid system.
Yes.
So why I'm asked,
divide and conquer.
Do you share these views? Do you understand what with this, or you don't accept that?
I'm trying to understand your question. I understand we're different places.
Hold on, Paul. Go ahead, Baba.
Yeah, because I mean I've been to many places around the world. Of course, I've met quite a few people with differences, mainly because of the culture that they're a part of. Because wherever you go, Europeans are not going to be exactly the same in terms of their language or their attire, what have you. But the agenda is the same. The problem is, and I don't think I'm answering your question, but I'm trying. The problem is that we don't understand their agenda. So it's easy to destroy us wherever we're at. The point of saying that we're African, if nothing else, the point of saying that we're African is because we need to recognize our identity in terms of our source so that we can use that like Garvey did, not like Garvey did, to organize African people into one. That doesn't mean that we need to be the same. I don't expect everybody, Africans in Australia and Africans in Brazil or Venezuela or Africans in Ontario, to all run to Africa or all look out and see each other as having everything similar, but to be in a position, that's what we talk about, sovereignty, to be in the position that we are a people and everywhere we are protected by us. However, you know, we behave, whatever it is that we do, to bring that back home, that's the importance to me in making that statement. I know there are major differences. There are major differences here in Atlanta, Georgia, in terms of the priorities of African people here, from the point of rejecting completely and totally the idea that I'm anything even remotely related to any African person, to be serious, down, hard, straight, I am African, period. I don't care where I live. So those differences exist. Those differences exist among Europeans. The problem is for us that they have been able to garner, they've been able to bring all that power to bear against other people. We need to bring our powers together so that we can create safe, sacred spaces for ourselves so we can be ourselves, who we are. And I think that when that occurs, we can look at our tradition as, well, Warrior Scars have already done, and identify what it exactly means to be African and to form ourselves into those kind of people.
You know what I think I was asking, right? I don't believe there's ever been a time in the whole of African history where African people have been one.
I don't either, but that doesn't mean that we can't.
Right, so what I'm doing...
That's part of the argument that I'm arguing, that I argue against constantly. I hear constantly the argument, we were never one. We, you know, we're there, we're different here, blah, blah, blah. That does not... That's the assumption that this is something that cannot occur. And to me, I find that extremely problematic when we're operating out of the idea... First we'll say, well, culture evolves, people evolve, et cetera, et cetera. But then we say what we can't do. When I was a child, there would be things that I would say. And my mother would say to me, can't die before I was born.
We can't
have a vision because of the way that it has been. Do we understand how Africa got to be the way it is now as a result of invasion, and that can't be reversed? We're saying that, you know, it's like, okay, I'm a chronic drunk, I'm an alcoholic, I smoke cigarettes, I do all the bad, nasty things in the world. And because I've done that all my life, are we saying that I can't turn into somebody who is well-disciplined, who walks around in my heart?
Yeah, now what I'm saying is that the point I'm trying to make from my observations growing up with Africans, what I'm saying is I feel that we're looking at it wrongly. I'm saying there's never been a time where Africans have been one. That's what I'm saying as fact. And secondly, Yeah, and secondly, what I feel is the solution. We should spend more time respecting and understanding each other's differences, how we are different, as opposed to having this illusion, as opposed to having this state of mind that we're going to all come together, because it really isn't going to happen like that.
Well, that's what I'm saying.
Hold on, Paul. Go ahead, Bob.
Number one, nothing is impossible. Nothing is impossible just because it hasn't occurred before. Nothing is impossible. Number two, I think it's very important for us to respect the differences. That's an African tradition. You go back and you look in the cities of traditional African society, you find all kinds of different religions there, all kinds of different spiritual systems operating within the same city, the same society, where no one religion or no one spiritual system dominates. This is our history. We are a history of embracing differences. In fact, we have the greatest history of that, or our story of that, on the planet. But that does not preclude the ability, that does not undermine, that does not prevent us from coming together in a political way where we control our world. So it's like the Berlin Conference. All these European countries that were very different in terms of their attire, in terms of their politics, in terms of everything except for, if you will, their spirit, they came together in order to dominate, control, take over the African continent. That didn't change them. That didn't make them into one people, if you will, in that way. But we still understand that they are one people, because when they operate against us, wherever they're at on the planet, they do the same things. So the idea that we have to be one people, that's not what I'm arguing for. That's not my point here. That really wasn't Garvey's point. Garvey recognized that there were some Africans who don't belong anywhere near Africa. There's some Africans who will never see Africa or see themselves as Africa or someplace that they want to be or what have you. The point is, well, I guess another point would be, then if this is not going to happen, then what should be the goal? The goal is our dissolution into other people's culture, becoming them, becoming sub-assimilated into European society, culture, countries, wherever they're at. What then should be the outcome of African people? Disrespecting differences. That's one of our issues now, where we are seeking out anything that's not African, that's different, in order to become a part of that. So this, the end result of this seeing, respecting these differences, is us disappearing essentially from the planet as a people, as a culture, as a society. And when you talk about the culture of Europeans, which we are adapting, that goes completely against every traditional African society I've read about in terms of their character, in terms of their spiritual connectedness. So that means that when we're out here searching for all these other differences and trying to be like all of these other differences, we become completely something the opposite of what we are. Europeans aren't changing.
Go ahead.
They haven't changed anything wherever they are. Their culture is the same wherever they are at.
I'm trying my best not to talk about Europeans or including you. I'm not talking about Europeans. I'm talking about us.
Why can't I talk about Europeans? That's the part of what we've become a part of.
Yeah, okay. One of the solutions, you asked about solutions we could do right now in the present, is integrate, meaning that you bring on and involve more people from the continent, from Africa itself, because I'm telling you something, you're going to get a different view. Young people, Pan-Africanists who are on the continent, maybe in Uganda, Zimbabwe, wherever they are, bring them on and let them talk for themselves, yeah? Because trust me, you're going to get a different view. Most of these platforms I listen to even involve these people, yeah? And it's a very... I say this with most humblest and respect. It's a very American ideology. And we've seen what American ideology has done around the world. They don't really understand what's in the world. They don't, seriously. So the point I'm trying to make is, right now in the present, I'm not talking about history or in antiquity. I'm talking about now. Bring on more Africans from the continent, young Pan-Africanists. I can give you a list of them. You can involve in your methods. And you're going to hear a different story, I'm telling you, because every week I hear them. We have platforms here, we hear them every week, who are actually on the continent today. And they tell you the reality, what's happening. And you hear the work, what really needs to be done. And it's coming from the horse's mouth.
What are they saying, Brother Paul? Brother Paul, what are they saying? What kind
of... We had a sister from Kenya, okay? talking about, and she's very much a Pan-Africanist, a Winnie Mandela type, young woman, brilliant, brilliant, explaining things about the ruling party, this Kenyan president, and how the different dynamics are being played out in the different ethnic groups. Yeah, it's just my observation. My observation is that those dynamics, which someone might refer to as tribal, I think that's very disrespectful to refer as tribal, because we have real differences. And how these tribal, for the sake of a better, how they interfere with us coming together, and they are deep rooted. They have nothing to do with the European. We use it. You talk about the European there a lot because you are wholly invented by the European. The European is what established your whole everything there. So that, you know, New York is named after James the Second, okay, the Duke of York. Everything is affected by these people. But I'm saying, when you listen to the Africans on the continent right now today, you start to understand that we have a problem than the Europeans, a much bigger problem than the Europeans. We have the problem we have to solve, the root of the problem is among ourselves. And those dynamics which are being played out on the continent are the same being played out in America, in Jamaica, in wherever you go, it's the same pattern. And I personally feel that if we spent more time, rule out the European, spent more time looking at our differences and worked out what's really gone on. Study Chancellor Williams' work. Study it. He talks about 6,000 years. He actually mentions that 5,000, 1,000, 6,000 year study. And you're going to see the same patterns being played out. And I don't think we've learned a damn thing from that. Not a damn thing. And we're playing that. The same things are going out. The European really ain't our problem. It really ain't. We need to look at ourselves and our behavior and our attitude to one another. That's what I... That's just my observation. I'm not asking anybody to accept it. We really need to look at it. Because I think if we could get that right, we won't have a problem with these people. And we need to talk about unity, because automatically we would unify, because we would know what to unify about. Thank you.
All right, Brother Paul.
I don't see how that's different than what I said.
Right.
I don't see the difference in there. And, of course, I'm going to talk about Europeans, because that's one of the reasons why Africa is set up the way it is now.
Right.
That's why you have this, quote-unquote, and I know that's a bad word, tribalism. That's why this exists the way that it is, because they've done the same thing everywhere that they've gone.
Mm-hmm. Divide
and we're not so centered on the Europeans. How are you going to eliminate the origin of the problem in terms of finding your solution when the origin has gone nowhere? And if I've talked to young folks on the African continent, particularly in Zambia, South Africa, so I understand the nature, and there's a difference based upon the condition under which that they were brought under the control of Europeans. You can find the same thing in the islands. It's different than what it is here, because it's a tourist place. It's a place for tourism. So their attitude toward Europeans and their sense of responsibility or their sense of understanding of the Europeans' role and what has happened to them is going to be very different because of the conditions that exist now. But you can't remove Europeans from the equation. If we were able to get together, that wouldn't stop them from doing what they're doing. They need to be stopped. They have to be stopped from doing what they're doing. Mm-hmm. You can't get around that. It's like you got to have an abuser, a murderer in your home, and you know you finally get the lease or whatever in your hands, and you pay for that. That murderer is still in your home. That killer is still sitting in your house. Yes, you have to get the family together in that house, which may or may not be possible in the immediate future. But you cannot ignore the fact that that killer is in your house. And it's seen by different people because they're living in different rooms in that house. So I understand when I talk to African people, or excuse me, continental people, which is what I prefer to say. I think that's not an insult. I understand why they'll look and say, well, why are you so focused on Europeans? I hear that all the time. I'm saying, why aren't you understanding how the continent got to be the way that it is? How are you able to sit there and these people are pulling resources from you, setting you against each other from the beginning, and they're pulling resources left and right every mm-hmm. day.
Every
constantly,
day.
Constantly.
Every day, yes.
And you're saying that you can solve this problem just by getting the different groups in Africa. That's how we became enslaved. You pitted one group against the other group, and these differences have grown over the years, and you're ignoring the source of these differences. You're ignoring the source of what started these wars in the first place, because you see more of the disturbances, more of the animosity between other Africans, because that's who you see there. It's like you can't see the hand that's controlling the marionette strings, the marionette wood pieces that hold the string up in place. You're acting like the people who are responsible for these places in Africa are controlled by Europeans. That they're not responsible for the governments that are operating over there or the companies that are operating over there. Yes, that would be beautiful. I think that would be phenomenal. I think that that would be the answer to all kinds of answers, as if you get African people together. But you can't do that ignoring the larger picture. You can't do that ignoring the European political presence on the African continent, like the African continent, because you don't see Europeans right now. They're coming. Because you don't see Europeans right now in your face, that they don't have an invisible hand that's operating the political machinery there. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm glad the young folks are waking up there. They're waking up more there than any place that I'm aware of. Mm-hmm. And has a lot to do with them being able to see each other and the problems being in their face.
Well,
but that's not the all in all.
Well, a lot of times they're able to do
that.
You've got to
remove the enemy.
Yeah, a lot of times they're able to do that because they see firsthand what's happening or not happening based on the Europeans' presence of eradicating and taking all the resources and not developing anything, you know, or overtly like South Africa, where you have a divided line. You see the opulence of what they're dealing with and the filth and squalor where you live. And they ain't gonna do a damn thing about it, you know. So, but yeah, man, we're running
goes,
up on that clock.
It goes so far, Baba. I'm thinking, and I'm not pointing out him because I know, like I said, I know many young African people. But your name is Paul, so the mentality that goes with that name. Why you got names? Yes, you're New York, New Jersey, New Hampshire, New Orleans, all of these new places that show you evidence of them being here. Names are evidence of them being there and part of your thinking as well.
Mm-hmm. So right now, Baba, tell me about some of the things that you have going on so we can announce that to the listening audience and any other thing that you would like to say in closing, brother.
Well Baba, I will tell you right now, we have this coming weekend, I'm going to be doing a lecture at the Black Dot dealing with Nana Amos Wilson. That's going to be this coming Sunday at 12 noon to 5 p.m. And the also I'll be online, in fact, on Wednesday night talking about this movie, Ma. Which I happened to stumble upon.
Okay.
But we're going to be talking about that. And also there is the, as you said, the event, which, surprise, surprise, I want Eniata to tell you about that real quick, because it's her baby.
Okay.
Hotep, Baba.
Hotep, Mama Ya. How are you, dear?
I'm fine. How are you?
I'm well. Thank you.
Good, thanks. So I appreciate this moment to tell you all about this healing event. So I think everyone's aware of the gender wars that, of course, African people didn't start, but that we are participating in, African men and women fighting each other. So the idea for the healing event is an opportunity for us to come together, for those of us recognizing that's insane. You know, Nana Clark said it will be all of us or none of us. So it's an opportunity for us to come and acknowledge that we've caused each other pain, we have received pain from each other, and to have participate in release rituals to release that pain, and for us to come together on that day to then going forward, what we are committing to our ongoing healing, but the love for each other and our working together to continue our nation building. So that's it in nutshell, Baba. It will be Saturday, July 20th. And that's a Zoom. Go ahead, Baba.
That is a Zoom presentation.
No. This is a live event.
Oh, okay.
Where we're literally coming together in circles to do this, and on okay. the tentatively the venue where the Bakasim Tsum Tsum
okay.
for people who attended.
Okay.
The last two, yes.
Okay.
But that's Saturday, July 20th, and you know the additional info is forthcoming. But
okay.
Definitely want people to save that date.
All right. Well, I'll be announcing it, and then when I get all the additional information, I'll be announcing that as well. So.
Yeah. Thanks, all right. Baba. Certainly
Always.
Appreciate you.
Always. Thank you. Okay, Baba Barudi.
Yes.
Thank you, dear brother. Thank you once again, and I hope maybe we can. I know school's about to start back in a month.
we have summer school, but that doesn't prevent you and I from being on here together.
Right on. Well, let's make it happen again, maybe before
yes.
the school starts. Also, to the AfriCorps, you have a number of brothers and sisters who are plumbers, electricians, painters.
This is Brother Damani's baby.
Okay.
And you know Brother Damani.
Oh, yes.
But he has been working on this for years.
Okay.
And he has finally developed a core of brothers and sisters who know plumbing and masonry and all the rest of that. And he has organized them in a way that they will be available for the community because they're a part of the community.
Right on.
So, you know, we complain about that. And he's done something about it here in Atlanta.
That's beautiful. That's great. Yeah,
yes.
Brother Damani's a good brother. So that's
yes,
handy,
yes,
handyhands.atl at gmail.com. Handyhands.atl at gmail.com. You get free quotes and so forth. The phone number to call, because I know, brothers and sisters, I got a couple of problems here I need to deal with. So I'm going to be making
you
this call. Yeah, 404-981-7691. That's 404-981-7691. I'll be announcing that. So brothers and sisters, and tell all the things that they can do, and you may have some handiwork around. Baba Barudi, once again, thank you, dear brother. You have
honor, Bob.
Always me. Have a blessed and wonderful day. I will talk with you soon. See you next week, Saturday,
yes.
at the Black Dot Cultural Center Bookstore and Coffee
Bar. This coming week, Sunday.
This Sunday.
This coming Sunday.
All right, Baba. Peace to you.
Okay.
All right.
Peace.
We end this program like we end all of our programs with the words of Stephen Biko. The most potent weapon in the hands of the oppressor is the minds of the oppressed. This program is dedicated and committed to helping to free the African mind. But not just the MIND, but the MINE, because under the feet of African people lies all of the resources everybody wants, think they can't do without, and they sure in the hell don't want to pay for it. Brothers and sisters, you have a blessed and wonderful day. Shem Hotep, that means go in peace. Asante Sana means thank you. Bibi Fahoria. Bibi Fahoria means our victorious destiny. Brothers and sisters, we will be victorious. Peace, family.